This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The former director of One Place, launched to help nonprofits in Kalamazoo, passed away last week. Tom Andrews left the organization this summer because of his health. Coming up, we have a segment of an interview with Tom Andrews that originally aired in August. But first, Adam Horowitz is the chief instigator at the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture. If chief instigator sounds like an unusual title, and if you had not heard of the Department of Arts and Culture, then you might have already figured out it's not an official government agency. Adam Horowitz will be part of an event called Imagine Justice on Saturday. It's being held at the Transformations Spirituality Center on Gull Road. Thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks, Gordon.
So let's start with the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture. What is it in reality?
Right. You gave it away. We're not a federal agency. This is a people-powered department. Unlike most countries in the world, the U.S. doesn't have a cabinet-level position for arts and culture. So in 2013, a group of artists, activists, policymakers began these conversations to imagine, well, what would such a department look like if we had it? What would its values be? And how do we, in a very grassroots way, with no resources at all other than time and people who care, begin to enact this department? So, you know, several years later, we've grown into an action network of thousands of people across the country who are committed to using creativity to shape a culture of empathy, equity, and belonging. Artists are a part of it, but it goes so far beyond artists to all kinds of people who are trying to figure out how do we make change in our community and how do we do it in a way that is creative and irresistible.
Give us some highlights of things which have happened over those last 4 years or so.
Sure. Our activities really ranged from supporting local organizers in their own campaigns to facilitating national actions. And I'll give an example. The People's State of the Union is a civic ritual that we do every year around the time of the President's State of the Union address. We invite people in their communities to invite neighbors to come together to share personal stories reflecting on the state of our union through story circles. And so this will happen in 150 different towns and cities. The stories are then uploaded online, and we have a group of poets who come together to compose this poetic address to the nation inspired by all of the stories submitted and then broadcast live, and people can kind of hear themselves reflected back. So that's an example of an action that we'll do where we're sharing a creative methodology, that being story circles, a very democratic mode of gathering and having difficult conversations across difference. And then a way of connecting those conversations and helping us all see the bigger conversation we're trying to have together.
So what do you think are some of those difficult conversations? What do we have trouble really getting at in the United States these days?
Well, there's no question that these are polarized times and really fundamental questions about what we value, what we stand for as Americans. The story circles that we'll do will have prompts like, share a story about a time you felt belonging or its opposite in this country, or just share a story about something that to you revealed the state of our union. And so what we're trying to do is move from the abstract arguments and the sound bites that we've heard on television to really invite people to ground their sharing in personal story. And that then becomes a place where we can relate more, where we can hear each other in a bit fuller of a way. And the story circles themselves also create an environment in which everyone has the same amount of time to respond to a prompt. So it's not the loudest voice in the room that dominates, and it creates a kind of equal platform for exchange. Many of the people who are drawn to our activities, it might not be surprising, are folks who might have a more kind of liberal-leaning politics, but through that, they're able to invite in other people in these conversations. So we have heard from folks refreshing accounts of, wow, this is the first time I was in a space with someone of a very different political viewpoint, and we were able to hear each other.
Do you think that art can be one of those ways, or arts and culture can be one of the ways that we do find what everyone seems to be looking for these days, some common ground where, you know, maybe we don't agree on exactly the same policy prescriptions, but there can be some sort of conversation about what the problems are and how we should be addressing them?
Absolutely. You know, we see a lot of art in times like this that is used for protest, that is explicitly making a political see a lot of artists in this moment in which much of the world seems to be a kind of dystopian reality, imagining alternatives and putting alternative visions out there that many people can see themselves in. And then I think the personal storytelling element, as I said before, really can help ground it. We just released a guide called Art Became the Oxygen, and it's a guide to artistic response in times of environmental or social crises. Highlights all kinds of projects in which people use art to bring communities together in times of real crisis, after hurricanes, for example, and just how much value there is in creating a platform where people can tell their own stories and not just be pegged by the stories that the media might tell about a place or the people in it.
So we went over what the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture is, but I should also go back to your title for a moment, Chief Instigator. What does the Chief Instigator do exactly?
I guess it's just a way of saying all the hats, all the time. So there are thousands of people involved. We're a very small core team. And Chief Instigator, I'd say, well, I helped start this whole thing. And to go back to your question of where it all began, I was living in Colombia in 2009 and 2010, and had the opportunity to do some work with their Ministry of Culture, and was pretty amazed by what a robust government agency it was. The kind of cultural infrastructure in that country, with community cultural centers and a ministry that really was supporting community level arts all across the country. And it was there that I printed out hundreds of posters for an imagined entity called the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture, and brought those back. Really wasn't intending to launch an organization until these conversations just snowballed, and it seemed like we should go from a set of words to actually trying to enact them. So instigating is the name of the game for me, and there are many other core collaborators. We have a chief policy wonk who really focuses on the policy side, and a cabinet with some wonderful titles, like the Minister of Revolutionary Imagination.
So this event that you're going to be at the Transformation Spirituality Center is called Imagine Justice. When you imagine justice, how do you see that then playing out with people who, I'm assuming will have some similar interest in the arts and in culture that you have?
Yeah, I think this will be an opportunity for folks in Kalamazoo and in the region to come together and learn about cultural organizing, learn from stories and projects and examples of how communities across the country have used art projects to push things forward in their communities. It'll be an opportunity to build relationships through the kind of storytelling and the story circles that I mentioned. And we absolutely will engage in some arts-infused imagining kinds of exercises, imagining the future of Kalamazoo and what does it look like and feel like when everyone has a sense of belonging in that place, and what would it take to get there. We'll also get a chance to kind of map out some of the existing cultural assets there and some of the challenges, and bring some kinds of projects that might help meet those challenges.
Is it your experience having, I'm assuming, been around the country a little bit, and as you say, even around the world somewhat, that of thriving arts and culture community, or a thriving arts and culture sector within a community, does something for them, does something that addresses perhaps other bigger societal issues, or perhaps has some sort of way of maybe moving the needle somehow on public policy?
Yeah, absolutely. And so many of the conversations we're trying to have with the USDAC, involve the idea that art is a part of any thriving community, but it's so much broader than art. When we talk about culture, it really has to do with the culture of a place and how it allows for the stories, the identities, the traditions, the contributions of many cultural groups to be present, to be valued, and to be honored. So yes, you might hear the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture and think about our theaters and our music venues and museums, et cetera. And we're really trying to broaden the policy conversation to look at culture in a wider view. For example, one idea we've been pushing is the idea of a cultural impact study. Environmental impact studies have been federally mandated since the 1970s. When you're doing new development, you have to show the potential negative impact on the environment. There's an endangered salamander species, and you're building a new stadium. How are you going to mitigate the impact? How might we develop policy templates and frameworks that apply that kind of thinking to culture? You're developing, you know, in a new area. How does that impact the people who live in that place, the meaning that they've brought to it, the kind of social fabric that they've woven over the years? And so, right, in that kind of asking, how might we expand for folks who care really specifically about having the arts in our community to this wider definition of what thriving culture looks like?
You wrote a piece for The Hill a while back about gentrification and how that can impact artists. Is that maybe some of what you're talking about there, that some decisions made on, you know, a very local government level in terms of development and in terms of maybe, you know, buying up property and that sort of thing, that there can be an impact on arts and culture, and that should at least be part of the conversation when making those decisions?
Exactly. Whether it is small town Kansas or New York City, so many of the artists and organizers we're working with are concerned about gentrification and about displacement. There's a tendency to see artists as part of the problem, and sometimes that's inaccurate representation, in that artists are sometimes attracted to areas where there's a lower cost of living, and their presence then brings up the value of the community, which paves the way for further gentrification. So when we talk about something like the cultural impact study, that is exactly meant to be a strategy to mitigate the effects of development in displacing the authentic culture of a place. And what we're hearing across the country is that artists really want to be a part of the solution. So, you know, for example, some of our folks in New York have really been partnering with housing justice organizations, figuring out how to use some of these creative organizing methodologies in partnership with them, bringing them into cultural spaces and raising the visibility of their work. And that, I think, is a lot of the work of the USDAC, is helping connect the dots and share strategies across sites, especially for creative folks who are trying to be part of solutions to issues like gentrification.
What has the election of Donald Trump meant for your organization in particular, and perhaps more broadly for artists who do want to address social issues in their work?
We saw a huge surge of interest after the election, people enlisting as citizen artists, and we have the disclaimer, you don't need to be a U.S. citizen or an artist to be a citizen artist with the USDAC. A lot of people writing in saying, yeah, I've been an artist, and now I'm raising my hand and saying, I want to do more. Can you connect me to the kinds of training or the kinds of people or projects that I can contribute to? If anything, it has underscored the need for this kind of people-powered network. It has allowed people to, I think, appreciate the metaphor that we're playing with even more. What happens when there is real dysfunction in government and in those departments? What does it look like to craft policy platforms, to create supportive networks outside of that, that can really be in conversation with government that does want to listen? So we've also had an uptick, I would say, in interest from folks in municipal government, city officials downloading our materials and wanting to be in conversation.
Adam Horowitz, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Adam Horowitz is chief instigator and one of the founders of the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture. He will be leading an event called Imagine Justice on Saturday at the Transformations Spirituality Center on Gull Road. Information about registration and other details can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Last month, I spoke with the former director of One Place, which is based at the Kalamazoo Public Library to assist area nonprofits. At that time, Tom Andrews had recently announced his decision to step down and focus on his treatment for kidney cancer. Andrews passed away last week at the age of 56. We're going to present a rebroadcast of that conversation, including some material that did not make the original air version. The interview with Tom Andrews originally aired in August. Thank you very much for being here.
Pleasure, Gordon.
So tell us, first of all, how did One Place get started? What was the idea behind it?
Sure. The idea of having what was called at that time management support organizations was not new. It's actually been around in Michigan for quite some time. And there was an interest in having something like that here to support the nonprofit sector and staff, board, and volunteers. And so a consortium of folks got together in 2008, led by the Irving S. Gilmore Foundation, Community Foundation, the library, as well as some other nonprofit leaders, to examine models that were used, because every one of these is set up a bit different. They're funded a bit different. They kind of do some of the same work, but they're organized differently. And they looked in Michigan and surrounding states, and they found one that was located in a library, and that seemed to be a good idea because the library being an objective place is not something that's going to be like inside a foundation or anything like that. It's somewhat more of a safe and objective space. And they also, when you go to the library, programs are free. And so they wanted to make this accessible to all, at least remove the financial burden. And so they wanted to make sure that the programming here would be free of charge to everyone. And so they put together the model for One Place to be located in the library. So the staff are employees of the library. The library provides a lot of in-kind support. That is, they provide the workspace, the computers, the back office work of HR and financial reporting and things like that. And then the staff write grants to Irving S. Gilmore Foundation, Community Foundation, and two, three other funders a year to provide the funding for this. So it's actually an ongoing collaboration of the Irving S. Gilmore Foundation, Kalamazoo Community Foundation, the library, with support from Dorothy Dalton and Harold and Grace Upjohn Foundations.
So is part of the idea to help nonprofit organizations, which are sort of in their infancy, that want to get off the ground and give them the ideas about how you can get started, what are the steps you have to go through to actually begin being a nonprofit organization?
That is one important aspect. And in fact, we're kind of somewhat of a gatekeeper in a good way, as a way to say you're interested in starting a nonprofit or you've kind of got some ball rolling here and you want to see, is this possible? And so we're there to basically probably talk you out of it because there's a lot of nonprofits out there already. And probably what this person's wanting to do already exists in at least two or three different forms. But every once in a while, that's not the case. And so we can be there to help guide them through that process and let them know what's involved with it. And then they take the reins from there. But it's not just that. And it's not just the small nonprofits or, you know, fledgling nonprofits. Certainly that's a group we address. But we're there for all sizes. We've had folks from Bronson come over. We've had folks from some of the, from Western Michigan University. We've had folks from some of the larger retirement centers and things like that, as well as medium size, small size. We're there for all, not just the staff, but also board members and volunteers.
And when you're talking about an established nonprofit, then it's a case of, can we help them perform better? Is that what you're getting at? Can we do this work in a better way?
Yes. It's kind of, I guess, generically, that's what these centers do now called capacity building centers, but is really to build their effectiveness and efficiency and their skills and supervision, fundraising, marketing, things like that. And we address that. At One Place, though, we've really kind of, over the last 5 years, focused in to become a focused leader development organization. Because what we recognize is that a strong nonprofit sector is critical to the success of any community. I mean, you know, you go into a room, almost everybody in the room in some way or another is impacted by a nonprofit. They're on staff, they volunteer, they're on a board, they sponsor, they donate, they're a patron or a client. Regardless of the socioeconomic status of the person, they're probably impacted by that. And also, The nonprofit sector provides the human infrastructure that supports thriving communities. You need to look no further than healthcare or education and the groups that support that to see that that's true. So when you really focus on developing leaders, and so our participation in that cause is to encourage and equip leader development. And so we see that, so we're not, as a way of recognizing that we have people who kind of take ownership of their role and really, you know, seek out the resources they need to get their jobs done at not just the executive level, but all the way through organizations, even in volunteer ranks as well, that are important volunteer positions. And so we want to, again, encourage and equip, meet them when they're ready to learn, meet them where they are, help them move those next steps. And what we find is that by doing that, the risk, of course, is, well, you develop these leaders and they'll leave the organization, right? Well, that may be true because some organizations don't have like a career ladder built in. They're just not that big. But what we find is people want to stay in Kalamazoo. So they may move to another organization. They may come back to an organization. We've seen that happen too. And so by focusing on individual leader development, over time, we'll strengthen the entire sector and actually connect them together so that they're working together more than just in their isolated organizations.
How different is being a leader in a nonprofit organization as opposed to being a leader in a for-profit business or maybe a leader in a government agency?
Yeah. On the one hand, I want to say there's not much difference at all. On the other hand, nonprofit leadership is harder. Generally speaking, you know, if you're running a for-profit business, you're in charge. You're the boss. It's your business. If you want to do something, you just do it. And generally, that's the way that works. And so, but you're running a small business. In a nonprofit, you're also running a small business. But you're also, while you may be the executive director or president, you're also accountable to a board of directors who is there as the representatives of the community because you are using community dollars in terms of donations and grants, et cetera, and maybe perhaps government funding as well. And then you also have constituents that you're accountable to. And so there's not just one bottom line. Sometimes you need to do the right thing, even though it may not be the most fiscally sound thing in the short run. So in many, and the reporting is, there's a lot more scrutiny on nonprofits than there are on for-profits, again, because of the use of tax-deductible donations and grants and federal dollars in that way. So in many respects, it's a more difficult type of role to do, a lot more juggling.
Does nonprofit ever get confused with non-professional?
I would think all the time. And it doesn't, and that kind of thing happens because there's a lot of nonprofits and a lot of folks just start things and they kind of don't know what they're doing. And so there's some basis in that as well. I've also seen businesses that were run pretty unprofessionally as well. So
true.
That's, you know, there's that. But it just in terms of what's required for the job, what folks should bring to the job, nonprofits need to be highly professional. Again, what I said about in terms of higher accountability, higher scrutiny, there needs to be a high level of transparency, again, accountability and authenticity, I think. You really need to be not only transparent, but clear of who you are and what you're about. Because again, you're accountable not just to your board of directors, but to the community itself. And they rightly should demand a level of professionalism and excellence.
What else do you see nonprofits out there right now needing? I mean, what could they use when they come into one place? What are some of the things that you're hearing consistently that they would say, hey, you know, if this were out there or that were out there, it would be a lot easier to run the nonprofit organization that we run?
I don't think it's what's out there, frankly. There's been a lot of studies, comparison studies of organizations that have been in similar situations and similar types of things. Some thrive, others don't. And it's not because of the circumstances out there. It's because of what they've done in here.
How they run their organization themselves.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's, you know, nonprofits are they're wonderful people. They're giving and caring people. And they want to make a difference, and they don't want to leave people out. And so it's very difficult to put a program out there and serve a population and then have to cut it off at some level and say, okay, we can't serve anymore. Studies are done every year, and everyone always says there's need out there that we could not meet this year. There's always more need than you could meet. And so the part of the issue is we stretch ourselves thinner, do a little more, serve more people, and we lose a sense of focus. And so we get a sense of burnout too quickly. And it diminishes the service we do to the core folks that we want to meet. So if I said, what would be the prescription, if you will, I'd borrow from Jim Collins and say it's conscious choice and discipline. And to say, here's what we're going to do. Here's what we could do, but we won't. Not right now, because we don't have the capacity. Here's who we're going to serve. Here's who we could serve, but we're not going to because we don't have the capacity. And we're going to do that really well at a high level of excellence. And once we get that solid down, where that's just standard operating procedure and we're hitting on all cylinders, then we can start expanding the scope of the population or the services we offer, but incrementally, so that 10 years from now, we're still not struggling underwater, but we're actually moving forward. You know, I've just seen too many people who are having the same conversations now that they had 5 years ago and 10 years ago, because they're just constantly living hand to mouth in terms of funding, in terms of staff, time, and things like that.
Can you tell us who Jim Collins is?
Oh, Jim Collins, sorry, is the author of Good to Great, and as well as other books, but Good to Great came out in 2001, and it's been kind of the business Bible for the last 15, 17 years, because you just see him quoted all over the place.
Going back to that question, though, of expanding in scope or limiting in scope, I mean, isn't the tough part for anybody who's running one of these groups, as you said, they're usually people who want to do the right thing. So when you're saying we can only do the right thing for X number of people for now, that's a tough thing to accept sometimes, isn't it?
It is. But again, that line's going to get drawn one way or another. You're either going to draw it because you know, it's just, you got to close the door because it's closed, or we ran out of money. So some folks are not going to be met at that point. And so the question is, do you want to be able to meet a greater need in 5 years, or do you want to be struggling to meet the same need and burning your folks out and constantly kind of living hand to mouth? And it really kind of comes down to that. It's hard to make the deliberate decision. I guess it's easier to just say, well, we ran out of money. We can't do anymore.
Then the decision's made
then
for
the decision's
you.
Made
you're
for
not
you, right?
making the
yeah.
decision to
you're not,
to
you're not
deny
cutting it off
somebody,
when
yeah.
it's like, but you got this. Yes, I know, but, you know.
Have to draw the line somewhere.
Got to draw the line.
As I read over your blog post, it kept coming up again and again that you really have enjoyed this position.
Yeah.
So how tough is it to step away? I mean, you know, obviously, as you mentioned, your health has not really cooperated here. That's the big problem. But how
yes.
tough is it to give up a job that you really do enjoy doing?
Yeah, it's my dream job. So, it was the right decision. It's a tough decision. But again, it was one that, as I've gone through this journey here, I knew was coming. It's just a matter of when's the time.
Tom Andrews stepped down as the director of One Place last month. The organization is based at the Kalamazoo Public Library to assist nonprofits in the area. Tom Andrews passed away last week. He was 56 years old. A version of this interview originally aired in August. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.